In the new book, The Spirit of Philadelphia, former Congressman Chris Gibson explores the enduring idea of the social state and its potential for renewal in contemporary society. It is America's story told through the history of ideas and a cautionary tale of what happens when a nation's spirit goes dormant. The book proposes a return of the American government to the philosophical roots as articulated by the U.S. Constitution and its framers. Grounded in realism, the founders successfully balanced the needs and rights of the individual with those of the collective, creating a system that prioritized both personal liberty and societal order. Gibson argues that abandoning the spirit of Philadelphia enabled dysfunction in government and disillusionment in the constituency. He writes extensively about how we get it back. Chris Gibson is the author of two previous books, Rally Point and Securing the State. We spoke to him at a live event at Kinderhook Books last month, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Chris Gibson to the roundtable. The Spirit of Philadelphia, a call to recover the founding principles. Let us focus for a moment on that word, recover. When did we lose it?
Yeah, so, you know, and I'm going to get to that. Let me just say, to be clear, this is not about going back. That's never possible. That's a fiction. But what it is about is understanding how the founders grappled with the issues of their time. Because, you know, there's a tendency in our schooling to either give like this mythic, you know, no mistakes, just incredible demigods, or the opposite. You know, they were terrible slave owning. And the fact of the matter is it was not an old man's game. You know, other than Ben Franklin, they were all fairly young. I mean, Jefferson was 33 when he penned the Declaration. I mean, Madison was in his 30s. So, but what they were grappling with is the fact that our young country was failing. It was going under. This is the spring of 1787. And, you know, and as we gather this evening, you know, we're in a moment for our own country where we're struggling. There's just so much vitriol, unfortunately. I mean, you see it on almost a daily basis. And then you see tragic events happening way too much. The social fabric in our country has been torn. There's a real concern that Americans have lost faith and trust in our institutions, in our leaders, and even in our neighbors. And we see dysfunction in the government. And at the same time, at the individual level, while we have so much to be thankful for here, you know, despite all those aforementioned troubles, I mean, levels of anxiety and depression are really off the charts. So we are in a moment where, you know, there's even some that wonder, can we come back? And, I mean, that really was the genesis for this project. Because, you know, somebody grew up here in a working class family around the corner. Bob's in the home now that my mom and dad raised us in. You know, yeah, we didn't have much money, but we really felt blessed to be here and just really optimistic about the future. And now I, you know, experience just like everybody else, what, you know, where are we as a country? I thought I wanted to go back and understand, you know, what happened. And, you know, I actually was initially encouraged to find out that in the spring of 1787, we had just, you know, gone through another insurrection, you know, that was the Shays Rebellion. But, you know, in the spring of 1787, states, because we have to remind ourselves that we were free and independent states at the time. We weren't even these United States of America yet. We were a confederacy. That was the Articles of Confederation. But states were coining money. States were actually entering into security and trade agreements with other nations. I mean, the fact is we didn't even have revenue because, you know, taxes at that level were really optional. And in fact, that's what caused the insurrection is one of the states was very excited to participate. That was Massachusetts. And in the process of raising that revenue, you know, the captain at the time, Captain Daniel Shays, actually, I think had a reasonable request. He said, well, if you pay me what you owe me, because I fought all those years and I wasn't paid. I'll give it right back to you. And they said, no, we're not going to be able to do that. We just want the money. And he said, well, then I'm going to fight you. And so I know that that sounds terrible, and it was, but actually I'm looking back and saying, you know, it's kind of remarkable that we actually pulled it together. And so when you talk about, you know, when I talk about founding principles here, one of the things I'm trying to do with the literature, with the scholarly literature, is I was disappointed to find out that Ivy Leagues, the NESCAC, which would be Williams College, where I taught, a lot of these considered top-notch departments of government and political science, there's really an interchangeability between philosophy and ideology. I think that's a missed opportunity, and I think that's part of the problem we're having here in our country now is, after this research, what I think philosophy is, literally love of wisdom, is essentially just two things. It's first, who are we, right? The Delphic command, know thyself, and then having a good appreciation of yourself. What does that mean for all of us as a community? What is our nature, human nature? And then given that, what do we do with power? What do we do with power? How do we want to array power? I think those two areas really encompass philosophy. Everything else nests under it. So like ideology, you can have a whole different set of concepts. Ideology being essentially ideas that nest together in concepts. But what united us and what allowed us to come out of that malaise of 1787 was the fact that even though they disagreed on a lot, many folks have now seen Hamilton, the musical. You know this big contestation between Jefferson and Hamilton. Yeah, I mean, it was unbelievably spirited. But they all agreed on our founding philosophy, which was that as humans, we were capable of extraordinary love and sacrifice. But if we're being very candid, we also had darker angels. We had moments when we would not be the kind of person we want to be. And so, you know, given that read of human nature that they all agreed upon, they believe that their read of history is that we needed to decentralize power and keep it separated, checked, and accountable. So, you know, that's what brought them together. That and the fact that they believed that we could do this, which the heads of state of Europe didn't believe we could be self-governing. But they thought that the only way that can happen, and they all agreed on this too, is that if citizens were educated, informed, and engaged in the matters of state. With those predicates, they actually liked their chances. And so, you know, that is the founding philosophy that united the country and allowed us to get up off the ground. When did we lose it? Well, unfortunately, you know, the Civil War has been written about extensively, and the casualties, the tragedy. Essentially, what happened to our founding philosophy is two things. One is the way it worked for our governmental system, it worked exactly as planned. And it didn't solve the major moral issue of the day, the slavery. The original sin of this country, the founders believed that with this original launching, this philosophy, they believed they'd actually resolved it. And Madison says this in Federalist 42. In Federalist 42, he said that that clause, the 1808 clause, along with legislation they passed just a couple years later, the Northwest Ordinance, they believed they put slavery on a path to actually be extinct. And they were wrong. And then when they got that wrong, what did our system do? Well, our system, the Constitution itself was a compromise meant to drive compromise. And what happened when we were faced with this issue? The system worked exactly as planned. We got the Missouri Compromise of 1820. We got the Compromise of 1850. We got a series of legislation later on. And ultimately, none of it worked. And we came apart. But when we lost it is, you know, Lincoln had a plan to bring us back together. He said, with malice towards none, we're going to bind up the wounds of our nation. And he was murdered. And the man who came in behind him, Andrew Johnson, was a committed segregationist and was not committed to Lincoln's program. And sadly, after the war, we never really reunited in a common philosophy. I mean, I joke that in some ways it was like Game of Thrones. If you've seen Game of Thrones, I mean, one of the themes throughout the Game of Thrones is who is the one rightful heir, right? So that's what happened with ideas, is we divided as a country with two major elements declaring that they were the rightful heir of our founding philosophy, but we've never really been united since then. So I've got more on that in the book, but this is really the result of this research. I think the major reason why we're struggling is we have walked away from the founding principles. We no longer have, I mean, we really don't separate and check power. I mean, you're at a moment when people are like, duh. But I'm telling you, my research is that really started about 100 plus years ago and has accelerated in the last 25 years. It's really been since 9/11 that we essentially do political change now by fiat. We do by executive orders and actions. And our system was always meant for us to work together. Our representatives, we're a republic, our representatives are meant to listen to us and work together to affect political change. And now, you know, it may seem like some pedantic academic point, but now essentially the president does this. And so to the victor go the spoils. I mean, the president effectuates the change, and the opposite, the party opposite, regardless of party, by the way, they all say, well, that's unconstitutional. And we have torn the social fabric because of this. I've watched this now happen for the last 25 years acutely, but it's been happening longer than that. And why I say the last 25 years is if you look at the 1960s, the Civil Rights Acts and the 1965 Act, you know, when you look at some of these acts, they were widely bipartisan. These were our representatives that supported these major changes. We don't see this anymore now. You know, and this is what has happened to our social fabric, is when our representatives don't work together, you know, we don't work together. I mean, that's what's been happening.
So if you look at what happened of you bringing up the 1960s, bringing up the Civil Rights Movement, other moments from the Civil War to today, and yes, of course, the last 25 years that you mentioned since 9/11. You write in the book, today all efforts to resolve our current crisis with reasonable politics have failed. Why can't we learn from those moments of the Civil Rights Movement and others that the guiding philosophy is that of power, but power for all as opposed to power for self?
Well, you know, the first thing is that one of the things we actually have righteous pride about is the fact that we're not trying to homogenize thought. We want people to have the freedom to think about any idea that they have, to express that. I mean, that's actually something we're enormously proud of. But what we no longer have is a dispute resolution mechanism. So, you know, people are rational, but they're also willful and emotional. And, you know, so the viewpoints on the respective sides right now are very strong. I mean, I move in and out of circles all the time. I move in and out of circles of people who support Trump very significantly, very vociferously. And I move in and out of circles with people who detest him. And the thing that I see in both of those circles is that they feel very strongly about their views. And, you know, the temperament to work together when you know you can knock your opponent out just by executive orders and actions, there's no longer that sentiment of working together. And, you know, this is where I think fundamentally when we changed the way we dealt with power, which was, by the way, not nefarious. If you look at Woodrow Wilson's dissertation, he actually says the founders got it exactly wrong. He totally disagreed with the idea that we should decentralize, separate, and check power. He said that just stands in the way of us doing what it is we want to do. So what we really want to do is consolidate power, and we can get more good done for everybody, right? Well, yeah, that assumes that we're in agreement, though, right? And it also, by doing that, you know, this is what essentially what our House of Representatives is now, is like a rubber stamp. I mean, particularly in the information age, when if you have a president, they can browbeat these members to say, I'm going to stump against you, and then you're going to lose in the spring in a primary. And so, you know, they're like, well, I guess I'll have to do what the leader says. And so a mechanism that was really meant for us to have a voice so that we could mediate our differences through the rule of law has now been completely obviated by the way we do change.
Chris Gibson's new book is The Spirit of Philadelphia. It is published by Routledge.
You say that you believe you have an answer to this, and I'm curious as to that. This is nothing that's going to happen quickly, is it?
No, I don't think it will, but one of the reasons why I'm optimistic is, you know, there's still, like, so many things, like even tonight. This, in many ways, is a great reflection about the founding of our country. You know, I mean...
Well, let's see how it ends.
Yeah. But, you know, I guess I'm assuming that there's a wide variegation of views. But here we are, right? We're engaged in the matters of state. You know, we're here, you're at a bookstore, which means that, I mean, educated, informed, and engaged. I mean, you're at a bookstore, you're supporting this endeavor. And I look at this, I believe we have the ability to regenerate ourselves. So this is one of the reasons why I'm doing a lot of these events. And I'm talking about in every circle. So whether it be strong Trump supporters or people who detest him, I'm trying to provoke consciousness as to the way we have changed the way we deal with power and the consequences of that. That's the philosophy. Knowing that, you know, any kind of ideology can nest underneath the founding philosophy. I mean, I talk about that liberalism and conservatism nests very well under common sense realism. And, you know, so there's a give and take about ideas. And incidentally, what I often find is even among, I'm still a Republican, the first ever in my family, there are those in my party and they believe that Republicans haven't been part of the change in the way that power is arrayed. That's just not the evidence. The evidence is both parties have been complicit in the consolidation of power and the consequences of changing those ideas. And I think that's, you know, they always say that's the first step of getting better, is recognizing we have a problem and then saying, well, you know, what is that problem and what are the ways that we can address it? So, you know, I am optimistic that if we raise the level of consciousness to the way that we have changed how we treat power in this country, I think we'll have a better chance of actually remediating.
But if I'm understanding correctly, that at some point somebody has to give, in the sense of, or mutual understanding that what we're doing isn't working, right? That,
yeah.
That somebody is making a mistake.
Well, yeah, I mean, so we've only talked about power to date, and that is a big one. But the other is then the resources, right? I mean, so, you know, a community wants to have a just array of resources. They also, it needs to be sustainable, right? So the fact of the matter is not only are we dysfunctional in the way we array power, but we're not going to be able to sustain our way of life, not just with the budget, but even resource depletion. And, you know, this is a major change from where we were. You know, at the beginning of our country, the American dream was essentially two components. It was, one is you are the master of your potential. You decide, you know, what are you going to do with your life, how ambitious you want to be, where you want to go. That is really, that's the Lockean liberal side of our political philosophy, as I explain in the book. But we also had a communitarian side. We had a very strong communitarian side, and that was not only do you get to control your destiny, but you don't live alone. We have obligations to others. We have obligations to our family and friends, to our community, to those in our state, and to our nation. We have obligations. We have a greater good that we need to balance that too. What that meant for the American dream is that generally folks wanted their kids to do at least as well, if not better, than they did. So, like, if you study the election of 1896, which, by the way, had a very high voter turnout, this was William McKinley and William Jennings Bryan. It was a very contested election. There was very spirited debate in that election. Neither candidate talked about spending $1 trillion more than the tax receipts. It was just unconscionable. You would never do that because you knew you were really going to screw your kids and your grandchildren. You would just never do that. It just wouldn't occur to you to do something that would so harm future generations, right? Now both parties do it. they have a reason, right? One party says, well, we're not taxing enough. The other party says, well, we're spending too much. When in fact, the reality at this moment is that given the pledges we've made to each other, we basically need about 20% of our gross domestic product to be spent at the federal level. And we're spending 23.5%, so we are spending too much, but we're also not bringing in 20%. We're bringing in about 17% of our gross domestic product. So the fact of the matter is, we're not going to be able to rectify our budget situation until we address both of those. So, I mean, I think that this bears on this problem. You say, well, we have to recognize there's a problem, and that means somebody needs to give. In fact, it is my read that actually everybody needs to give a little bit.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, everyone has to. But there has to be, again, there has to be that understanding of what the baseline is going to be, right?
Yeah.
That seems to be the hard part.
Yeah, I make a case for 20%. I mean, keep in mind, that's only for the federal level, right? Because then you have the state level of the gross domestic product and you have a local level. So what I was looking for is a target that's sustainable, something that we can do that can facilitate growth so that the American dream can continue to move forward, but also something that, you know, we're going to be able to address from a spending and a revenue standpoint. I can tell you I'm not alone on that. If you look at budget experts, they have said about the same thing. And incidentally, how this is tied to power is that the parties are completely, almost diametrically opposed, with some exceptions. You know, one party believes that we should keep the spending about where we're at, but just raise the tax level. The other one says, no, we're just going to cut the spending. But the other complication at the moment we're in, like today, is that we're going to have a situation where potentially where we're cutting spending, but also increasing the deficit. And I think that's a real problem, because the fact of the matter is this, we're going to have to work together. If we're going to get out of this, or we're going to fail, if you sort of look at it from a problem set in that way, I don't believe we're going to fail. But if you look at it that way, that we're either going to resolve this matter or fail, the only way we're going to resolve it is if we work together. And we're going to make it harder for ourselves if we cut spending and don't reduce the deficit. It's going to make it, whatever mountain we think we have to climb to work together to get out of this, it's going to make it, you know, geometrically harder.
Just by a show of hands, how many people are legitimately concerned that we are going to fail? Yeah.
Yeah, it's not surprising. So for the folks on the radio, I mean, it was a little more than half of the folks. I mean, this is part of why I started this project. I feel this. I mean, I'm out, I'm listening to folks. There's a real concern, and it's not by party. I mean, there's a real concern across ideological spectrum and across the partisan spectrum that this country could fail.
But that has to be part of the equation too, right? I mean, we have to be ready. We have to identify the exits and all possibilities, correct?
Well, I mean, you're talking to a guy who spent 29 years in uniform. I mean, yeah, you have to war game everything. But I don't believe it. We're not destined to fail. This is really a book about ideas and their consequences. And I think what's really important, you know, this was not done to us. This was not done to us. This wasn't China. This wasn't anybody, you know, inside this country that may, you know, a finger may be pointed at them and as perhaps a scapegoat. You know, this is something we did to ourselves. And but the good news of that means we can solve this. We just have to recognize that we have a problem. And then I've laid out the last third of this book are a series of reforms that we can take to restore trust and faith in our system, which is a major issue that we're having right now, to reawaken the spirit of Philadelphia. And I do want to say a word about the spirit of Philadelphia. I think this is really important. But then also to try to bring balance to our lives, both private and publicly, balance to our lives. And then I also give some insights into the type of leaders we need right now. Because I have found that depending on what moment you're in, you need different kind of leaders. And we're in a moment where we really need someone who gets the sort of greater good. So I argue here for what I call communitarian leaders, folks who spent their whole professional life either in the military or in the caring sciences, including doctors, nurses, social workers, in the pastoral business, a preacher of some kind. But you get the point. Somebody whose whole life, you know, teachers too, I mean, people who have spent their whole life serving others. That's the moment, because we don't use this language. I mean, there's times when you do need a business person, I think, to lead, and there's times that you need like somebody who's an insider, somebody who really knows the machinery. But the moment we're in right now, because we're going to need sacrifice, we're going to need hard work to get out of this, and it's going to take everybody given. We need somebody who'll get out front and lead. And so, you know, that's what I'm hoping that will this conversation will engender is an understanding of the moment we're in. Joe, I do want to say that the spirit of Philadelphia, what is the spirit of Philadelphia? I mentioned to you how close we were to potentially failing in the spring of 1787. I mean, the fact is they just met about 6 months earlier in Annapolis. They actually tried to resolve it there. They tried to amend the articles. That was our first constitution was the articles. And they couldn't reach consensus. I mean, part of the problem was you had to have all 13 states to agree or you couldn't change anything. They could never get that to be done. And that's among the many things they learned is that can't be the threshold. They fixed that with the Constitution. 2/3 of the House and Senate, 3/4 of the states. They knew they couldn't continue to do business that way. The interesting thing is they had a good diagnosis of the technical things that needed to change with the Constitution. They just needed to find a way. So what they did is, I call it in the book, the indirect approach. They actually spent a lot of time preparing. You know, Madison asked Jefferson to send him a trunk load of books from Paris, and he did. So he had the latest. You know, Gibbon had, he was writing 8 volumes of The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. By that point, there were 6 volumes out. This guy, Madison, read everything. He was a nervous, you know, guy, and he was, if anything, overprepared. But he wanted to understand, you know, what is this moment we're in? And so he was prepared intellectually for this moment. Because you mentioned earlier, Joe, you said efforts to try to fix this moment we're in by direct politics fail. Well, because people go right to their corner. They're ready. I'm talking a very large percentage of Americans go right to their corner and say, we've got the answers. And the other side does the same thing. You know, we've moved so far beyond, like when I was a boy, there would be disagreement and the other side would say, you know, they're wrong. Now it's they're evil. It's not even that they're wrong. I mean, we forget the fact that we're still a people. We are a psychological community and we're estranging ourselves with that. So, I mean, that's why I'm trying to be very careful in my book talks that I'm actually trying to reach Trump supporters and people who can't stand him. I'm trying to reach everybody to say, look, here's this moment that we're in. When the founders got together, they worked really hard to try to bring the technical changes. What actually got them to overcome was when they finally agreed to a compromise between large states and small states. This is the Connecticut Compromise that you remember from school, but there was something that was different this time. Sherman actually proposed it. He was a guy from Connecticut. He did get some sponsors. You know, it happened about 5 weeks in to when they had gathered, and when they actually found agreement on this major issue of how to array power when it came to the legislature, for some reason, they were overcome by a spirit and things that looked hard, things that had they started, like what they should do about executive. Because the fact of the matter is that what we had initially was just one body. I mean, the Continental Congress did every function. They did legislative function. They actually did the executive function. That's where John Hancock, you learn about him. He was the head of the administrative committee. And they didn't do a lot, but they did some of the judicial function, the Continental Congress. So once they actually found a compromise with the Connecticut Compromise, they actually were able to tackle the executive. They were like, wow, we didn't think we'd ever get an agreement. You had Alexander Hamilton essentially proposing a president for life with complete veto power over the legislature. People were, you know, the musical tells you, people were aghast. He talked for 6 hours, right? You know, if you listened to that or saw it. That was actually helpful because they're like, okay, we know what we don't want. So it actually got them talking. So the spirit of Philadelphia was a coalescing energy that overcame the delegates. They're like, we can do this. We're not going to fail this time. We're going to get this done. And that spirit permeated. It got them out of Philadelphia that they actually voted for it. And it actually ultimately carried us to ratification. And there have been moments. And, you know, even in our lifetime, we felt it. Remember 1980. When we put, you know, a bunch of college kids on the ice against the Soviets, right? And we had no business competing with them at that time. That was their pros. And they were never expected to win. They won. They were overcome. When they asked them, they said, what was it? Well, there was some coalescing energy that overcame them. And remember how much that lifted us? It still gets me emotional thinking about it to this day. So we're capable of this. The spirit is not dead. It's dormant. And we need to reawaken it. And what helps us reawaken it? It's working together. And that's why this power arrangement, and by the way, I'm not alone at this. Social psychologists back this up. When Truman made the decision to integrate the armed forces, right? What he was trying to do is he said, you know what, as Americans, we need to be able to work together. We got to be able to do this, right? And they're like, well, how are we going to do it? We're going to do this. Truman said, I'm just going to do it. He was actually, there was some literature at the time, but it's all been proven now. The fact of the matter is humans, if you want to change attitudes, sounds counterintuitive. You change behavior first. You change behavior, and all of a sudden, the person you're working with, you're like, man, I hate that person. And you're like, except for they saved my life. Or, you know, they really were there for me when I needed it, and my, I didn't see that coming. And what happens is because of a term the social psychologists call cognitive dissonance, your brain actually does the work for you. You actually choose experience at the end of the day. You say, well, you know, I don't feel that way anymore. I'm moving. This is what I'm saying. This spirit of Philadelphia, if we change the way we array power in this country, we will recover this muscle. We'll recover that spirit of Philadelphia.
Again, the name of the new book is The Spirit of Philadelphia. It is published by Routledge. Chris Gibson will participate in a book talk with the Fort Delaware Historical Society in Narrowsburg, New York, on July 5th at 4 p.m. To learn more about that and many other upcoming events throughout the region, you can go to his website and the site for the book, thespiritofphiladelphia.com, thespiritofphiladelphia.com. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.